jazz.
Busted.
Are we ready to get started on whatever this baggy monster is? I mean, maybe you've got more direction than I do. It's kind of just...
Yeah, we're going to do some talk about talking, I think. And then all right, so yeah, let's start. And I think I have an intro. I have a thing.
Awesome. Okay, let's meta this bitch up. So welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 200.
200. They said it couldn't be done. No, they said, why would it be done?
They said they didn't know it was being done.
Right.
And now they're calling the authorities.
That's right. They said, is it done?
God, we hope it's done. Is it over yet? Anyway, I'm still, after 200 plus episodes, Pat.
I'm still Mike.
And you've got something in the chamber for us. Please,
right.
Fire away, my friend.
We have, we occasionally get letters from, would you call them fans? I don't know. That's a pretty strong word.
Most people who write us are very kind. I don't know if they want to call themselves fans. That might be
fans is a strong word.
They're listeners. They're appreciative. I certainly appreciate what they have to say.
Interrogators, antagonists, inquisitors.
Rarely.
Whatever. So anyway, we got a letter from someone. What was his name? You remind me of the name because you actually
read all the court. Let's call him Steve. I don't know that we need last names, but Steve,
right.
who told us he's about 71, so he's older than we are. It's good to know there's still people who are older.
Uh-huh. Yes, for a while yet. And Steve basically, he posed the question to us, where is the, was it Kind of Blue? Was that his example?
Well, yeah, you know, it's an amazing email. I really enjoyed reading it. It goes on for some length, gives his personal history about jazz when he first encountered Kind of Blue in a certain young lady's basement with some vodka purloined from her mother's capacious liquor cabinet. And then he talks, at some point he gets to this and says, I would posit that jazz is a closed musical style. This isn't a put down. I think all styles close eventually. By closed, I mean that you can play in a style and write in a style very capably, even cleverly, but you'll find it difficult, if not impossible, to innovate in that style. I love jazz. I've dedicated my golden years to finally understanding it, say how to play appropriately and convincingly over a waned shorter tune. But I have no illusions that I'll do anything really fresh and excitingly new, nor do I expect to hear anyone else doing that in jazz.
Right. So this was kind of we took this as kind of a challenge, you know. I take it both of us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just one more sentence before we go.
Ahead.
Can you name a single new jazz tune from the last few decades that holds up next to anything on Kind of Blue?
Right.
Or In a Sentimental Mood, or Footprints, or Freedom Jazz Dance, or Round Midnight, and a dozen other Monk tunes, or Name, well, let me try again, Nema, or Las Vegas Tango, or Infinize, or, you know, so we just, is there anything out there, he says, in the last few decades that could match these performances? Sorry, I'll let
right,
you go.
That's okay. So we kind of took this as a kind of a challenge. So Steve, challenge accepted, to identify, you know, the Kind of Blue, as it were, or, you know, the potentially classic album that's been recorded in the last 10 years that in 100 years, people go, oh, that was, you know, a milestone. That was a nodal point along the way of the evolution of jazz. One point that I take both you and I to sort of agree with axiomatically is that jazz is not a closed form, that it continues to evolve and it continues to, you know, borrow from the old and invent the new and stretch out into new regions and new sounds new oral landscapes. I don't think either one of us believes that jazz is a closed system. And you can tell that we think that simply by the nature of this podcast. We listen to and talk about albums from the past, sometimes from, you know, the very far past, 100 years ago. But, you know, we review and talk about, you know, the most recent things that are coming out. So, you know, the very nature of the podcast tells you that we think jazz is not yet a closed system. Nevertheless, it seems worthwhile to take up Steve's point and make an effort to identify some of the important albums, let's say, in the last 10 years that might really kind of, you know, stand up to the test of time, that, you know, 50 years from now, people will listen back to our podcast and say, Pat and Mike, you idiots, you got it right, or whatever, that there's some albums out there that really will kind of be landmarks of the form. First thing I want to say, by way of just kind of introducing this topic, is that you did a list, you did a spreadsheet of albums just from the 2010s that we've covered, and we've covered a shit ton of.
Yeah, roughly 250.
Yeah, we've actually.
I mean, a couple of them aren't jazz, but I mean, for the most part, yeah.
I mean, so we actually have made a real effort to dig into the new and the recent and stuff that's catching people's attention, in addition to just stuff that we get as review copies that may not be earth-shattering or life-changing, but that is still jazz and, you know, represents the evolution of jazz over time. So Pat thought what we should do is a kind of a podcast, and the way I want to think about this podcast is this. At the end of every podcast, when we're done, you know, holding forth and making fun of each other, we spend a few minutes figuring out, brainstorming, plotting what we're going to do for the next podcast. And it usually takes a few minutes for us to whittle down to four albums, with the exception of the infamous podcast 10.
Weather Report, yes, I know.
The entire group of Weather Report on me. So we generally whittle it down to four, and sometimes we figure it out right at the end of a podcast, and other times it takes us a couple of days to kind of strike that balance. And we often, sometimes it's one of us brings most of the items to the table, sometimes it's both of us. So I think of today's podcast is a kind of look into the workshop of Mike and Pat. And we're actually going to sort of take the listeners along our thought process as to how we pick stuff. And here's my suggestion for what we should do. You have helpfully identified a number of articles and best of lists for the 2010s that you thought we could kind of look at and make some comments on. And I think when we reach the end, we should make a plan over, let's say, I'm going to say four podcasts to look at, let's say 16 more albums from the 2010s that we haven't looked at yet. And I'll explain how I want to break the 16 albums up at the very end. So this is kind of my opener, as we're going to kind of walk through this process and talk a little bit about some of these lists and what we think about when we think about what's worth diving into, what would be worth exploring. Does that make sense?
Yeah. When you're done, I'm going to go to run about three caveats, and then let's dive in and just ideas or hypotheses for us to play with. But let me know when you're ready. This is other kinds of stuff. It's a little different. It's a little bit even more meta. But
go ahead.
Okay, so I guess I want to acknowledge as we do this that I do sympathize with a lot of what Steve is saying, even if I want to resist it. And so I think there are three things to think about in play here that do make this hard. One is that at my age, just like at Steve at his age, we are never likely to form a relationship with anything released in the last decade or the coming decade the way we formed a relationship with the music we heard in our 20s, if nothing else, sheerly because we can never experience the repetition and life spent with recordings coming out now. In other words, I do think it matters. One, I mean, I think most of us are more receptive to new music and new experiences when we're younger, but also just my experiences with the kind of blues stretch back decades, just like Steve's do, back to when I was minus one in his case. So if I run into an album that I really, really love, and that does happen less often, but you know, there's a reason for that. I don't necessarily think it's a drop in quality, but I can't. It's a very rare case where I can bond with it the way I could bond with something that I bonded with in my 20s, just because my bond with, you might think that you were enjoying Kind of Blue as, you know, as much then because you back project, but my sense is really having lived with it. I mean, it's a bad example because really I've kind of worn that one out in a way I can hardly listen to it anymore because I've heard it so many times, but whatever albums you love, the relationship keeps deepening. And I think when you think about when you first heard it, you project that deepened relationship back. And it's something that's hard to earn with something that comes out as you get older, because there's just less time and your time is fuller. And there's all this backlog of music that you do want to return to because part of a relationship with it is repetition. So just a thought there. Another thought is all the examples Steve gives were releases on major labels of the time. In other words, in that era of jazz and of music, large, relatively speaking, organizations, institutions created the music that listeners held in common. And there was a natural limiting of supply and sifting of quality. And that sometimes failed awfully. I mean, obviously big record companies produced crap. I think less so in the classical and the jazz fields than the pop, because, you know, the A&R men had more contempt for the young audience and so often just 10 years for what they're trying to find. But there was just a limit to what you could experience. And the people that made it to get their music out there had gone through one hell of a sifting process. And my guess is that a lot of the albums that we think are the best from the last 10 years didn't go through that process. I mean, aren't necessarily coming through the few remaining large labels. So there is a kind of plethora of music facing you in this decade that was just not there 50 years ago. I mean, it just couldn't exist. I mean, it could not have been produced. The tools weren't there. The economics involved were impossible. The distribution channels weren't there. It was a limit. I mean, you know, Miles Davis put 2 or 3 albums out a year, but the whole catalog of jazz released in a given year is a tenth of what comes out now. So just that's something else what you're dealing with is that, you know, if you're asking what was the good albums in the last 10 years, who the fuck can tell? I mean, we listened to 250 records from the 2010s in the last 8 years. We talked about them in some depth. We touched very few of the records from the top, you know, the 4 lists I dug up of the best jazz from the 20s. We certainly got a few. I mean, it's not like we, you know, missed every one, but my God, you know, it's just, so there's that to deal with. And then finally, you know, is jazz closed? And the more I thought about it, it's like, let's think about the era of professional music that's distributed on recordings, which is now over 100 years. But, you know, 120 years maybe at most. That era, I feel like increasingly I see it as systems. Some were in place already, like classical music. Some are kind of more or less gone, like folk music. I think once recording really dug its claws in, was there really any folk music left? I mean, music not made by professionals at some level? Hard to say. I mean, most folk musicians we think of are professional musicians. They've learned a craft. They didn't just kind of spontaneously warble wood notes wild, right? And I think within those groups, there are kinds of music, you know, the very popular music people want to dance to and get drunk to, the music that the thoughtful kids pour over every meaning. And it could be a rap album. It could be a hard rock album. It could be a prog rock album. It could be an alt country album. It could be a number of things, but where you feel like the artist has had more say, there's more personality and thought going into it and a little bit more challenge. And then there's whatever jazz is, which is this liminal art between popular and art music that makes heavy demands on the listener and that has a lot of instrumental components to it. Is it always going to be called jazz? Is there a lot of jazz being made the mold of that kind of music when it was professionalized 80, 90 years? Of course there is. But I kind of think as long as we're in this era where professionals largely make music and it's distributed, there's going to be a place for music in that liminal space. Largely instrumental, one foot in popular forms, not about everything being written out. So I don't know if jazz itself is closed, but I don't think that that space in the professional music zone is going to disappear. It's just hard to imagine it doing so. There's always going to be a small but eager audience for it, whatever you want to call it. Just, okay, three big thoughts, and we may decide they're all bullshit by the end, but just want to get them off my chest, and let's get down to the work of actually thinking through this. So how do you want to attack this and look at?
Let's just start by talking about the different lists. Let's start with the, and just go in order.
Okay.
In the order that you presented them to me. So Jazz Times produced a list of their critics, you know, top 10 lists for the 2010s. And I have some initial thoughts about this, and I want to try and piggyback on some things you've already said. If it's true that jazz is far less, let's say pure, let's say pre-curated by a small set of labels that are kind of the gatekeepers for the music, if it's now less true because there are many more labels and there's all kinds of self-publishing of music, and so there's, you know, people have access to recordings, performers have access to the technology of recording, there aren't these label gatekeepers anymore that there used to be. So what's striking about the Jazz Times list is how enslaved it is to what remains of the major labels. Yes. I'm just going to rattle off some of the labels that are mentioned most often in the Jazz Times critics list, which is, I'm going to make the argument that it's just a kind of a conservative list. Blue Note, ECM, Concord, Pi. And then you start to get into some things like Sunnyside. They crop up in a few places. Nonesuch, obviously, in a number of cases. Impulse is still alive and kicking. So Impulse is still around.
Or right? Alive again, right?
Yeah, or alive again.
For a long time. Yeah, but yeah.
It's once again alive, right? But that's not to say that there aren't some self-published or small labels represented on this list. But my God, this, you know, if you're just looking at the labels, I would say well over 50% of their top 10 picks year after year come from what remains of the major labels. And what that means is the people who they've picked consistently as the best 10 of the year from 2010 through 2019 tend to be people who are deeply rooted in a recognizable tradition. In many cases, these are people who are doing modal jazz or versions of modal jazz. There's a fair amount of, you know, cross-pollination with Latin music, but it's all still very much within a kind of recognizable tradition. And if you look at the names, there are plenty of names that are themselves links to a previous era. So I'm going to pick someone like Brad Meldow as a link to a previous era, right? Brad Meldow is, you know, an important performer today, but he is deep in the tradition and he is completely connected to the tradition. He was, you know, gigging as a sideman with, you know, greats in the tradition. Then you have actual people who are part of that tradition themselves. Roy Haynes, Keith Jarrett, Sam Rivers, right? These are names to conjure with. Wadada Leo Smith. These are people from, you know, Wayne Shorter. These are people from the previous generation. Terrence Blanchard, right? So you have these people who represent the tradition, and then you have major figures who are I would argue, kind of transitional figures from the old to the new or from the old to the contemporary, right? And then you have a small number on their list of people who are breaking into or fitting into that tradition, but they often have the imprimatur of a label or side work with other people or just the fact that they perform currently in a recognizable idiom, right? So let's take the vocalists Cecile McLaurin-Salvant or Gregory Porter. No one would argue that they are revolutionary figures. They are wonderful vocalists who do their own thing, but they are in the tradition. You know, they are in the tradition. So that the Jazz Times list, to me, looks like something that Steve would really like. It's going to have a lot of things that are going to sound like or remind him of things that he's heard before. There are going to be a lot of links. Go ahead.
But I mean, I feel like his email, just to be fair to him, is not necessarily asking for I think what he's saying is it's repetition.
I'm happy as I can be. I've learned to love and to live. Devil may care. No blues or woes. Whatever comes later goes. That's how I take and I give. Devil may care. When the day is through, I suffer no regrets. I know.
You know, one thing I noticed just thinking about this is that this last decade, if nothing else, you can say that jazz vocalists, we had an unusual crop. I mean, you know, you go back Kurt Elling, when you think about a major, major female vocalist and a major, major, who's kind of annoying me now, but hugely talented male vocalist, both come up in this decade. I mean, when has that happened recently? I mean, they're always churning and promoting. Right. You know, new voices. I mean, vocal music sells a little better. And it's a little bit more relatable than instrumental music. But I don't know that any decade has come up with Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and Gregory Porter equivalents of that talent load that I can think of in the last two or three decades back. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something obvious. There's certainly been brilliant ones. But it just seems like an unusually ripe class. Anyway, just a thought. But yeah, I mean, these are for sure. This was an article I found. If you look, best jazz the last 10 years or whatever, this guy basically saying, you know, he was taking a look at Jazz Times, and he does this. He's kind of being almost comic about it. Who does it boil down to the best being? And, you know, he comes up with an answer and runs these top lists. And I can understand the appeal of this because, as I said, you know, there's some days when we've got a couple independent promoters sending us review stuff. I mean, there's some weeks I've gotten 8 or 10 records in a week. And a lot of them are quite good. You know, I just listened to one recently that was not and should not have been produced, but, you know, published. But, you know, mostly they're all at least competent. But what the hell? I mean, what do you do with that kind of flood? And we aren't getting stuff from Blue Note and ECM in our inboxes, but it's kind of hard to imagine.
Which, if you're with ECM or Blue Note, hey,
yeah, there you go.
Phone already. Jeez.
Well, to be honest, I gotta say, I don't know if I want the most recent. You know, it's okay.
Well, there's some stuff I'd rather them give me than pay for.
Right? Yeah. There you go. So yeah, this is very much. I mean, Pi is not a big label. Sunnyside, you know, they've been around. They're real labels with real producers. They've got a history. They are independents, and then the so-called old independent labels like Blue Note and Impulse and Verve, those are all arms of corporations. And I'm not saying they're bad or they don't have good AR people, but just, you know, they're no longer. I mean, Blue Note in the beginning was in fact independent, you know, and then it stopped being independent sometime in the late 60s. And now it is part of a corporation that's, I think, largely allowed to do its own thing. But, you know, it's by no means way or shape independent in the sense of a label running all on its own funds with its own resources by itself. So, yeah, this is the most, by far, mainstream, conservative, familiar name set.
Right.
You know.
And having said that, right, I mean, so, I mean, you know it's conservative because, I mean, you still get, you know, lions like Sonny Rollins, right, who was still producing stuff in 2014. Wayne Shorter appears a couple of times, you know. He appears for Eminon, which we both thought was, well, not his best. And a great way to appear on this list is to already be a still performing major figure from the past, which is the only explanation for Charles Lloyd.
he just can't stay off of it. I mean, again, he's not bad. He's not like he makes bad
there's nothing wrong with his stuff, but it's like, really? You know, I mean, really? He made six of the best 100 albums in the last 10 years. I just don't think so. I love Vijay Iyer, but he's on here like four or five times, you know? And it's like, really? Is every one of his releases one of the best, 10 best of the year? So, you know, if you're already famous, that's a good way to get onto the Jazz Times list, which makes me interested in the weird stuff. So, for example, who's the flake? Who's the weirdo? Who's the outlier at Jazz Times who keeps nominating Chris Davis? I mean, there's some weird shit. And Chris Davis is on here twice. Chris Davis is in that, you know, weird constellation of outliers like Mary Halverson, right? And this is a minor label figure, right?
Right.
And then occasionally Jazz Times will just nod to what is kind of mainstream opinion, right? So everyone fell all over themselves about Kamasi Washington's work. Kamasi Washington's The Epic, right? And everyone fell all over themselves about Christian Scatatunde Ajua's work, and he appears on the last list. I felt like it was good for us to listen to and talk about Kamasi Washington, but I'm not sure. I think he belongs on all of these top 10 lists, right? But the fact that certain figures appear on this relatively conservative list and on some of the other lists we're going to talk about makes me think, well, that's an interesting triangulation. That's a weird, if that person is in the center of the Venn diagram on a bunch of these and we haven't listened to them, maybe we should. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Christian Scatatunde needs to be on our radar, if only for that reason.
Yeah, I guess I talked about a live show that I found very impressive by him, but I cannot remember if we have done.
We had talked about it, and then we didn't for a variety of reasons.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's,
That would be interesting. I mean, it feels like anyone who, so my initial reaction to this list is it's deeply conservative. It's a lot of the usual suspects, many of whom I adore, right? I mean, Sam Rivers, you know, I got no problems with him. That Henry Threadgill makes that list a couple of times is awesome.
And he's arguably in a purple patch. I mean, I think he is. It's just like right now, I think Carla Bley, I mean, her last few albums, I've liked all of them. And that is just not the case of any other stretch of Carla Bley's career. There's always a couple clinkers. So certain people as they age, and I don't know. I mean, I have not felt that kind of magnetism from the Charles Lloyd stuff I have heard. God knows I haven't heard all of it because I don't have a house made out of money. I mean, my God, the guy won't stop. But there are some artists who, I mean, Threadgill, I think for a while there with Zooid was in one of his more productive patches on a massive career. Did it hurt that he'd already been in the game for decades and was, of course not. That brings him to the attention of a place like Jazz Times. But, I think probably his stuff's going to hold up a little better in 30, 40 years' time than Charles Lloyd, who, and you know, it's funny because Kamasi Washington, in a way, is what Charles Lloyd was in the 60s.
Yep.
But, you know, the thing about Charles Lloyd in the 60s is if you came into jazz in the 70s and the 80s, no one talked the fuck about him. I mean, he was a very popular figure who did not get anthologized and collected and fetishized, who kind of was taken for granted, I think, by people who hadn't lived through the Woodstock period, and is not that significant, you know, as kind of a pastel version of Coltrane.
Yeah, he was regarded, he was a pop culture god for a short time.
Right, right. And that doesn't help your, typically it's like, you know, will people ever take, I don't know they need to, but like a Chuck Mangione or whatever. I mean, not that I don't think his music was equivalent to that, don't get me wrong. But, and now he's kind of retroactively canonized, I think in a way because he came back made music in some ways more serious and challenging than he had in the 60s. And he's, you know, this link to this, you know, this epic era. I mean, my God, is he that much old, you know, younger than Coltrane, really? He's just still here. And then I'm wondering, is Kamasi Washington, do you think anybody's really going to be hot about his recordings 30 years from now? I think what excites people about him is he's reaching the kids. He's populist. He's somebody that seems to draw the attention of someone who does not read Jazz Times from time to time.
Right. And he has the, you know, the bona fides of having played on any number of, you know, hip hop albums. And this brings me to a rant that I've been thinking about for a while now about hip hop. And I guess I want to piggyback on something you've said before. And it's something something we need to meditate on or think about as we move forward. Right. You've talked often about, you know, the GAS, the Great American Songbook. And the Great American Songbook was for decades a source for jazz. And then it became this sort of sclerotic impulse, right? And do we really need another recording of this song or that song? And you've often opined that it would be useful for jazz to enlarge its canon to connect to contemporary pop music or, you know, whatever music that...
Or music that was only 30 or 40 years old. What the hell?
You know? Right. So that, you know, jazz has always been this amoeba that engulfs other music forms, transforms them, and uses them to revivify itself, right? Jazz is kind of the great music revenant in that respect.
Manuel Loggins, Johnny Kamai Warren, Justin Sip, Amadou Diallo, Kimani Gray,
some of the people who are on this list, Ambrose Akamusare, for example, are people who have this sort of these hip hop bona fides who they've played on. You know, Robert Glasper is another one. Kamasi Washington. These folks who have roots in hip hop, who have roots in rap as well as, you know, in contemporary R&B, and then use that to kind of cross pollinate with where they want to go in jazz. And I guess I have the following caveat that I've been thinking about for a while, and I wanted to break it out and try it out on you now before we move into these other lists. The problem, well, I foresee a problem with using hip hop or rap as a kind of thing to incorporate into the future of jazz. And I say that as someone who makes and continues to make a really rigorous, robust effort to listen to new hip hop and new rap and old hip hop and old rap to try and educate myself about this music, which much of which I like a very great deal. Okay, so I'm not an expert, but I'm not a novice in this form. Here's my fear, or I guess my worry about jazz borrowing from hip hop and rap. You've talked about this before. Hip hop and rap, their main what they do is they'll take a rhythmic motif, and then they'll sample something, and then you get words over this rhythmic motif. Hip hop is so much about the beat. It's so much about the rhythm, and it's not about the melody. And what I wonder about is when jazz has cannibalized other music forms in the past, it's primarily cannibalized melody and transformed melody. And I wonder how jazz will be able to cannibalize rhythm. Is that a thing? Can you cannibalize rhythm? Can you cannibalize a form that is itself already cannibalizing other forms of music? Can you be a second order cannibal?
Well, there are lots of recordings of jazz that have hip hop beats in them. I mean, there's no question, right? I mean, even someone like Ben Allison stuff, right? Yeah. Ben is by no means the funkiest dude on the planet or something. You know, some of those rhythms behind him are at least reminiscent of some. I think, to me, it's not the form. It is that so often when jazz deals with rap, what it does is get someone to perform an often not greatly written, in, you know, brand new thing to rap with jazz, right? In other words, it's just they get a rapper and the person rap, but it's not like they're covering 99 problems, right? They aren't taking something that is iconic and known and shared and saying, I'm going to take this and then I'm going to deconstruct it. And you're going to know where I start and recognize where I end. If you've got something of an ear, it won't be a carbon copy, but there'll be things you can recognize if you're somewhat musically literate. And then you're going to see what I do with it. So often it's just they integrate a rapper and it's always originals. And this, to me, that is a great bane. You know, obviously they wouldn't have to ever touch rap in that the music of the 60s and the 70s and the fucking 80s and the 90s, you know, there are Elvis Costello alone, his songbook, there's got to be 10, 12, 15 songs in it that just would be so easy to translate into jazz terms. And people just don't do it. And I think there's financial, we've talked about, right. We've talked with real live musicians who explain that if you want to press a CD and it's got a cover song on it, you have to pay the rights holders for every CD you press before you sell the fucking thing. And so, yeah, that is when jazz has become this very marginalized, very underfunded project where you can't even afford to do an ancient cover of a Gas song, much less the latest Eminem hit or whatever. You know, it's probably just financially difficult to play this stuff. But I what I'm thinking is what's been lost is, and of course, in a sense, our shared cultural memory of music is itself been so fragmented. We don't have mainstream radio to speak of anymore. We have all these siloed music listening locations rather than something in common. We listen to music in earbuds, not on speakers, except for my neighbor, so I could hear some Grateful Dead. God bless him. But it's not playing covers of things. Can you imagine Fats Waller rapping, by the way? I mean, parodying some rap songs. I have a feeling they would be so funny, I would pee myself. You know, I wish Fats Waller could be brought back from the dead and, like, exposed to rap and just do his own version.
Well, and that's, you know, yeah. It feels like sometimes, and I listen to a lot of rap, and one of the main things it feels like it lacks to me oftentimes, not always, there are examples, but a sense of humor, a sense of self-mockery. The very nature of much rap is the boast, is the brag, is the put-down track, and that's not self-mocking. You know, it's a boastful mode. So it's, I just wonder. I get the impulse to feed off the energy of rap and hip-hop because that is where a lot of cultural energy is. I totally get it. I just wonder how successful jazz is going to be. Borrowing, transforming these forms. I guess what we've seen or what we've looked at hasn't been that mind blowing to me. What we've looked at so far, but I am absolutely willing to say we haven't looked at nearly enough music that attempts to, you know, grapple with that transformation. So maybe there's a lot more to be talked about there. But it's something that I'm curious about because, as I said, it feels like when jazz has borrowed in the past, it's often borrowed melody. Sometimes lyrics. It's never been a form that existed primarily as a kind of that they're focused on just the rhythmic, the beats, right?
Well, so here's a great. Sorry to interrupt, but I want to make clear, listeners. Mike knows something about rap. Pat doesn't know shit about rap. Pat's listening to like dead white guys from 200 years ago. That's his new thing. I'm getting deeper into classical as I age, and that's just, you know, I'm not against it. I don't think it lacks artistic value at all. It just has not reached me in a great level. There's a couple just absolute stone classic albums I've enjoyed and gotten into. But I was going to say an example actually of not a rap rhythm, but a rhythmic hook that gets used brilliantly. And I don't know if I've sent this to you. I got Lonnie Johnson. No, let me try again. Lonnie Smith's All in My Mind, which was a rare Blue Note Tone Poet album from a recent production, The Organist, and he covers 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Did I ever send that to you?
I don't think so.
You have got to get this album. This album, it's a 5-track version. Maybe I talked about it on the split weird-ass thing where I talked about some vinyl I picked up by myself so we could squeeze an hour out of scraps we had left over. And I'm so glad I did because it's been a crazy summer. Anyway.
Oh, no, I do have it. Why do I not remember this? Thank you.
anyway, great, great version. And they actually bring in a different drummer just for that one track to play the Steve Gadd lick that anchors 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. So in that way, I mean, then of course they're also using, I mean, chord changes, the harmony patterns, crucial. And one difficulty when you leave the Tin Pan Alley, the classic Great American Songbook, is that they do write, in many cases, certain standards have harmonies that I can best explain as, if you've been playing a while, seem to play themselves, and they just feed you ideas. You're just playing along with them. It's like, I can't go wrong. I could do this for 10 choruses. There's something about the harmonic matrix that just makes life simple to play. And then some later music just doesn't have that harmonic richness. Doesn't mean it's not valuable. Doesn't mean it doesn't have other things to offer. And that's a problem with more recent pop music. And then obviously, to some degree, rap just doesn't have harmony at all. Right. I mean, it might have melody in a sample. It's mainly rhythm and it's linguistic creation. And of course, often improvisatory linguistic, you know, so that in a way is similar or reminiscent, you know, of fitting spur of the moment ideas to a pre-existing pattern or rhythm or, you know, just framework and going with it. I don't know. I mean, I think in general, jazz has struggled with dealing with pop music. And one theory is just that the kind of people now who play jazz often just have not had an involvement with. I mean, they chose the path as a rejection of things they did not like. I mean, I've maybe told the story before when I was like pledging to our local WBAA station, the Sheep That Never Sleeps, plays classical music out of Lafayette. I called this lady on the whole tele thing. And one of the things you could get for your donation was a copy of Dark Side of the Moon. And she literally, I don't know if this is the right one or not. I'm like, let me find out. Is it Pink Floyd? I mean, she just never heard of it. She either was the most brilliant performer I've ever encountered. I mean, God, I wish I recorded it. It was the funniest phone call I ever had. I'm like, I'm sure that's the right thing. It's okay. You don't have to ask. Oh, you're asking. Okay. It is the one by Pink Floyd. Great. You can send that to me, you know? And I'm thinking, you know, who doesn't know Dark Side of the Moon? And the answer is people who just spent their whole lives blocking out anything that wasn't classical music. And I think there's a part of the generations of jazz musicians after, say, the 60s that grew up like that. And I was a little bit that way as a kid, you know, a young kid. I'm like, I don't want to deal with Kiss. All right, I'm still that way as an adult. I was not ready for popular music at that time. It took me a while to kind of loosen up enough to deal with it. And some people just don't. So I wonder, part of it may be that jazz musicians literally just did not have a relationship with it. And if you don't, then you can't fake it. You can't, if you don't remember this song from your childhood, the way Thelonious Monk remembers some of those weird-ass standards. I mean, he heard There's Danger in Your Eyes, Cherie, at some fucking point. And it stuck with him, probably because he thought it was hilarious. But it meant something to him when he played it. So I think that's the problem. I think the financial thing, that you have to pay these guys. I mean, there's the music business is literally stacked against jazz musicians because there is no recognition of the value you bring to taking something pre-existing and enhancing, expanding, and just dismantling it. There is no reward for that. It's like the person who wrote it gets something. The person who took it apart, made it greater. I mean, Billie Holiday did things for standards that the writers never did. She made them better. She didn't get money for that, just for selling the recording, her little stake in that. But they kept getting money every time she made their shit better. So there's that problem. And then I don't know whether it's just a perception that even if they listen to pop music as kids, that this is a different thing and it doesn't meet that jazz has to be art. I'm sorry to rant, but. There's so many reasons. I don't know why this has happened, that jazz has lost touch with popular culture and known things. And I think the problem is that there is a percentage of people who at least will recognize an instrumental version of a familiar thing and have some place to begin when you do variations on it. And if it's all originals that are almost certainly not as memorable, or let's be honest, good, as that popular music in terms of just composition, that bridge is broken. And I think your audience shrinks further. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, this is my hobby horse. It has been for 8 years. But anyway, that's my little rant on that.
By way of introduction to Stereo Gums List.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So we're going to go through these and then maybe later go back and okay.
Yeah, I have an idea about how we're going to
go back. Great. Awesome. Okay. You're driving the bus. So this
let's,
is, yeah.
Let's, So what's striking here are the things that turn up in both places. And some of these things are things we've talked about. Nicole Mitchell's album, we haven't talked about this particular album, Mandorla Awakening 2.
I'm up for it.
You know, yeah, I'm up for it too. But we have talked about Darcy James Argue's Secret Society, Real Enemies, which is probably our least favorite of his recordings.
Yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol,
we've talked about Branford Marsalis's Four Motherfuckers Playing Tunes. We've been told to talk about Flip the Script.
Oh, we did. Yeah, I remember that. That's a fucking good album. I mean, I'm up for it. I don't know if it's one of the set 20 best from the last decade, but I mean, that doesn't seem
Stereo Gum lists
ridiculous
it,
to
right?
me. Yeah.
They list Cecile McLaurin-Savant. They list Donnie McCaslin before Beyond Now. What I'm interested in are the things that they list that are also on the deeply conservative Jazz Times list that maybe we haven't listened to. So Linda Mahan O's Aventurine is on both lists.
Okay.
Don't know anything about her, never heard of her, right? Strikes me that
I
we
feel
should...
like I have, but I don't, I thought of her as a bass player, but I guess she does a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's bass, drums, and occasional vibes. Okay.
Yeah. We have said stuff about Esperanza Spalding.
I don't think we've ever done a record, though.
But we haven't, right? Ambrose appears on both lists.
Yeah.
And we both have thought, we need to think harder about him.
It's because he's smarter than we are, man. He's just, you can tell he's smart. His brain is big.
William Parker's Wood Flute is on there. You know, you could pick anything by William Parker and put it on such a list. Matana Roberts, Coin Chapter 2, that appeared on another list. I don't remember it's on the Jazz Times list. And then, of course, Sons of Kemet. Have we reviewed this?
God damn it. You know, we did. And there has been, I mean, another story of the 2010s has been a kind of flowering and explosion of talent in England.
Yeah. Shabaka Mainly, Hutchings.
Yeah. And Hutchings, he is a major player on bass clarinet on Yaz Ahmad's Sabatous, or however you say it. Mm-hmm. I have found Hutchings stuff on his own. I feel like maybe we did one, but to be kind of a little too... Yeah, I don't think we've done it. I think I've listened to it. I've thought about it. I'm up for it.
I do believe Sons of Kemet, Your Queen is a Reptile, appeared on both this list and Jazz Time. So that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Also, they list Tyshawn Sorey. I've got a couple of things by him, but I've never heard of that one. Of course, Kamazi appears on their list. They have they throw a bone to Mary Halverson. Henry Threadgill, we love Henry. Jamie Branch's Fly or Die is number two. And number one is, and he was on the other list, Christian Scott of Tunde Adjua's The Centennial Trilogy. So that feels like something we should listen to. If Jazz Times, a relatively conservative list, and Stereo Gum, a more adventurous list, both have them, that's an interesting sort of, you know, crossover, right?
And it's just to think about this. I mean, one thing that's just emerging from this is that the list of 100, the list of 20, how few crossovers there are.
Right.
It gives you an idea of just how crazily prolific and unfiltered this field is, that there is not more agreement, you know, that it's just, anyway, it's kind of amazing, you know, just how many things are out there and how people that think about jazz all the time can't, you think near the top of the mountain, there'd be the most similarity, right? That'd be the edges where people, you know, the 100th best album, people are going to pick some odd things, but the top albums of the decade there's not that much overlap. Yeah, but I'm up for question.
Not much at all, but where there is, that strikes me as something interesting to consider. So the next list we have is, what is this, happytv.com?
I have no idea.
Where did you find this list?
Googling. You know, I just literally, you know, top jazz albums of the decade, and I never heard of this. I mean, they it's interesting, too. It's just because it's like, these are the best contemporary jazz albums in the 2010s. Now, first, they call them contemporary jazz. That used to have a very specific meaning.
Right.
Which was kind of the easy listening, slightly electrified branch. I don't think it quite does here, but it does seem like it's a little different bucket they're drawing from. Yeah.
So their list has a lot of outliers, things I've never heard of that don't appear anywhere else. They do have Henry Threadgill at 22.
Right.
They mentioned Godtet, which appears on another list, so we might want to think about that. Thundercat. Any list that mentions Thundercat cannot be a bad list, by definition. Love us some Thundercat. But when you get to the higher levels of the list, here are some repeaters. Matana Roberts, Coin Coin, Chapter 4.
Oh, right? They bring up Moses Boyd. We talked about the group he was in anyway. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Snarky Puppy, The Necks, Bad Bad, Not Good. And then number 8, Sons of Kemet, Your Queen is a Reptile. So that's three lists that this album is on, right? And then right at the top, we get Kamasi Washington at number 2, and then King Cruel, who I've never heard of, but is part of this London scene. So that's kind of interesting.
He has single-handedly changed the game. Yeah, I guess I'm assuming that this website is kind of maybe based in England, or it seems like not entirely. I mean, obviously Snarky Puppy is a very American outfit out of the North Texas state, but anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. So that's three lists that have a fair amount of variety with some interesting overlap, some places of overlap. So here's my thought for four upcoming podcasts. Okay? So here's my thought, Pat. This has been a long, strange wedding between you and me, but we've never really celebrated this pairing. So what I think we need is a series of four podcasts, and in each podcast we'll look at four albums from the 2010s. And we really will try and hone in on stuff from these lists that we haven't already looked at. We might, in let's say there might be some cases where we revisit an album. You know, I would say no more than one album per week.
Okay.
That we revisit an album that we've looked at before, but we thought, shit, it appears on a couple of lists. Let's look again. What did we miss? Maybe we're missing something that Stereo Gum and Jazz Times noticed, right? And I suggest that we break these lists into, you're going to laugh at me.
Okay.
Week one will be something old. Week two will be something new.
Okay.
Week three will be something borrowed. And week four will be something blue. And we can choose four albums to fit that incredibly vague rubric however we want over the next four podcasts as our effort to identify for Steve something that might – stand as a classic 40 years from now, recorded in the 2010s. What do you say to this project over 4 weeks? Something old, something new, something borrowed, something new.
Sure. Yeah. And again, I think with the caveat that it's a fool's errand, and that, of course, we're going to do our best. It's impossible to tell.
Right.
Where everybody's conditioned by the moment they're in, and it's very hard to kind of get a bird's eye view of what's going on when you're in the thick of it. Or a sense of what is going to last and what is just kind of by the moment, the cultural moment you're in is not just of it, but kind of conditioned to look attractive by it in a way that 10 years from now, with those particular concerns by the wayside, when it's more quote unquote a question of art, it's not going to look as strong and other things are going to kind of come to the fore. And just that, you know, 40 years from now, I'm certainly going to be dead And I won't have the relationship. I can have the relationship with this music that I have with Kind of Blue. And that's not that it's not valid or whatever. It's literally in the terms of my biological through story. I will never be able to let it carve the paths in my synapses. I just don't have time or energy or focus the way the stuff I encountered as a kid has. And that's okay.
Pat, 40 years from now, we'll be in our 90s and we'll still be doing this podcast and you'll still be saying, fuck Kamasi Washington.
That's right. I'll be doing it from a jar. But
he will have already won a Nobel Prize, and you'll be like, I hate him. I don't like this.
I'll say, Joyce, lower a microphone into the alcohol that I'm floating in, my head's floating in, and I'm ready for another podcast. And she'll say, okay.
So for something old, here's my thought.
Do we want to talk about the final list or not? I mean, it's up to you.
Oh, what's the final? Oh, that list was really confusing to me.
It was. And again, guys, I want to be honest. I just Googled and looked and said, okay, here are four thoughtful, with different sources. Jazz Times, well-known. The other one's less known to me. I've heard of Stereo Gum, never heard of TV Time. And then whatever the fuck this last one was, Riot Material. There's a lot of culture blogs out there. This is the one that picked Charlie Hayden and Hank Jones Come Sunday.
Yeah.
I swear to God, if a terrorist kidnapped me and said, could this be the best jazz album of the decade? I just laugh in his face and probably be put to death, but I'm like, maybe it is. I mean, I just look at it.
Del Feo Marsalis, Sweet Thunder.
That I got. I mean, I want to hear.
I'm not going to believe it for a minute that it's one of the best.
But yeah, so this was a very odd, very personal one. He just said that Come Sunday by those two people who, Hank Jones, I love. Charlie Hayden, I respect. And I think he's done some great music. I don't know that in his latter days I found him all that scintillating. And I'm just thinking, these are two very, very old guys in a piano duet doing church. Maybe it is great. On the looks of it, I never think that it could possibly be. So that was the last one. It was just like a list of several albums, some of which I never heard of.
Right.
Anyway.
There were some that struck me as interesting, right? So...
Right.
Out of that list, I thought, who is the, there was an AAC, there was an AACM refugee in there somewhere. Keelan Philip Corin and the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. Have we done the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble?
God, I feel like maybe we have. Let me check.
And we liked the hell out of them. And I'm like, that sounds cool.
Yep, we did. Hypnotic Joints back on episode 139 in 2017 joint.
Koran gigged with Sun Ra, so I'm like, that sounds interesting. I would want to hear about that album. There was a couple of albums in there that I thought, hey, this might be worth a go. I do think, something like the Miles Davis bootleg series, we're not doing that.
It came out to me, that makes no sense. I mean, not
right.
that it may or may not be, pardon me, a great.
Right.
And actually, that's one that, God, I love the Great Quintet, but one thing I've learned as I've explored this live stuff is that their moment of brilliance wasn't infinite. And these recordings sometimes just sound self-indulgent, whereas the Plug Nickel stuff is some of my favorite music. So
yes.
I'm glad to have more of it. You never say no to more of the Second Great Quintet. It's interesting music. Some of it, I'm sure, is pretty great, but... Overall, the lesson I took from that is like, why am I not listening to this again and again and again? And I think I feel like the egos were starting to implode by that point for whatever reason, or just at that moment. Maybe they had another great moment later, but those recordings just don't have the magic that the best of their stuff did. But of course, it's not music from the last decade. It's music found in the last decade.
Right.
No.
Here's my
okay.
thinking on All something
right.
old, something new, something
sure,
borrowed, something
right.
blue. So for the first list, something old, we should pick four albums from the 2010s. And this will probably be dependent heavily on the Jazz Times list. Who are the lions who some people think are still making classic albums?
Right. The old people is what you're
the
saying.
The old people. Exactly.
Okay.
So let's go with Square in the Tradition. Established figures who appear on that we haven't talked about, and we'll just grab four albums from that Jazz Times list.
So are we going to do that now, or do you want to do that after the show?
Let's tell the kids. Or
all right, okay.
You so, want to pick four? I mean, and then it's before that we haven't done.
I get it. So we've done some Charles Lloyd. I feel like we've given Charles his hearing from our point of view. Not saying you can't live up.
No mas.
Do you want to do Rollins road shows? I mean, that's a complicated situation. They are not from the recorded that year. They came out that year.
When were they recorded?
Over various shows. I mean, I've got at least one of them. I don't know if it's volume 2. It might be. I think I've got the disc, so I could tell you, you know, if I looked it up when they were done. I feel like it's closer to being, I mean, I think you could say in a way it is a product of that decade in that.
Right.
Now, I don't know.
Now, I think in one, like, for example, for one of the years, 2012, I think we've actually talked about all 10 of those albums on the podcast.
Maybe Accelerando, 4MFs. We've certainly done. Yeah, we did Centennial.
I think we did all 10 of those.
Yeah, good for us. I think we're right.
We've covered it, you know.
I'm pretty sure we did 10 Freedom Summers. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm fine with doing one of the Sonny Rollins if the music is recorded in the 2010s. Let's follow the rules.
All right. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, we're going to put a question mark by that one.
Well,
but
Roadshows 3 is also on the list, so.
Okay. Yeah, so Sonny is disqualified. Almost all the tracks from the Volume 3 were, in fact, from the 2000s, not the 2010s. So.
Nope, no Sonny. Good.
Okay, good enough. All right, votes.
I'd really like to hear the Dave Holland, Chris Potter, Good Hope.
Okay, known figures. We like Dave. We like Chris. Sounds good.
Go
sorry, what's it called, New Hope?
It's from 2019, and it's called bloop, Good Hope.
Good Hope, okay. Sounds good. I hope.
Yeah, I know. I'm just sort of trying to pick people who we think we like a lot.
Yeah, it is funny. One of the games that we play with these lists, is I'll look at the ones I haven't heard. I'll be like, no, I don't think so. No, it's terrible.
No, that could happen. Skip that. Hell no. What others do you jump out at you? There's one near the beginning I saw that I thought we should look at.
Yeah, I'm looking around it because it depends on how old you want old to be. In a way, you could argue Pran for Marcellus is old. He's been doing this since the 80s.
Right. And we do dig him. So I'm fine if you want to do a Branford album. I think we should probably, if you want to get into tradition, we should do the Lee Konitz, Meldow, Hayden, Motion live at Birdland.
I've heard those aren't very good. I don't care what they say. I got at least one of them. I'm sorry. I think that
he's
thing
not
is,
in good form.
I don't like him much at all.
Okay.
What do you think of Pat Metheny's Tap, John Zorn's Book of Angels?
I think it'll be a trip. I wasn't going to suggest it because I thought you wouldn't like it. We're doing something old here. That might be not something old.
Okay. Well, I mean, he's even older than the Marcellus is, but okay. Yeah,
no, when I say something old, I mean in the tradition.
Okay. All right. So it's not necessarily just...
Not an old guy.
Jared Hayden, Last Dance. I don't know.
We could do that.
That's one I haven't heard. Okay, it's a possibility. We're putting down possibilities. We're going to pick out something old. I'm assuming that would be more or less traditional stuff.
There's
you know, Jarrett was in the Jazz Messengers. I had no idea.
That's amazing.
It is. It's weird.
2017 is a bad year for this purpose, with the exception possibly of the Jeanette, Grenadier, Medeski, Schofield album called Hudson. I don't know what that is, but it's the Jeanette, Larry Grenadier, Medeski, and Schofield.
I give it a try. Yeah, I've heard of that record. I have not heard it.
I'm assuming you don't want to do any Meldow, and that's fine for our purposes here. But when we say old, we're just meaning someone who's, you know, in the tradition, who's established.
Okay, okay.
You know, major figure. So that's why I was leaning for that. Someone early. Do you have any interest in doing... Keith Jarrett and Charlie Hayden's Jasmine?
Well, I mean, I saw Last Dance. I think Jasmine is the other album from that session. We could do that instead of Last Dance. I'd be up for that.
Either one. And then also Joe Lovano is on this list. And we need to maybe talk about Joe again.
Okay.
He's a problematic figure. I feel like he's incredibly self-indulgent.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, monstrous talent. And definitely... as in the tradition as you can get.
So is his project that we... Five Bird Songs.
Bird Songs. 2011.
No, I, you know, I'm...
Don't have to do it. Just throw it out there.
Us Five Bird Songs. Oh, I'm sorry. Joe Lovano's Us Five Bird Songs. Okay. Sure, it definitely is, and that brings in Esperanza, I think. So what we've got here for the old, which we're taking as not necessarily chronologically, though these guys are mostly not youngsters, just kind of solidly right. in the tradition, no names sort of thing. Dave Holland, Chris Potter, Good Hope, Keith Jarrett, Charlie Hayden, Jasmine, Jazz of Yours, Jazz Mine, Hudson, a supergroup, Dejanette, Grenadier, Medisky, Schofield, and Joe Lovano, Us Five, Bird Songs. Is that? I'm up for it. I'm not even
plausible. What do you think?
I've got some Lovano Us Five album. I just can't remember which one. We'll look for that as we move on.
And that'll be a chance for us to talk about Joe. Did we talk about past present or no?
John Schofield's album. I mean, we've talked about him for sure.
I'd be willing to sub that in if, let me see, let me go back to music here real fast for a second, because it's recently been in the rotation. Let me make sure I have this right.
Okay. We did a Sko album.
Skip it.
I want to say not millions of years ago. And of course, Sko is one of those, we did past present. We did it on 113.
Okay, then let's not do it again. All right. So that looks like four. There you go.
Okay, cool. All right, something new.
Let's worry about that later. Let's worry about it next time.
All right, so we've got the plan for week one, something old. Next time we'll worry about something new.
Yeah, and something new should be like just the most cutting edge ear-splitting shit we can find.
Sounds cool. All right, we'll think about that using this list as a matrix.
And so definitely, I think that's where Christian Scatatunde should appear. Maybe Linda May Hanno, because she appears a couple times.
My Queen is a Reptile. That seems to be the favorite one. And for sure, and we'll be doing this every week for the next four weeks after this. Listeners, chip in. If you've got, I'd say.
Absolutely. Tell us what we're missing.
Three or four at most. Don't go crazy. We know that there may be dozens of albums that you really loved or really think were outstanding. But if you have a couple that you think, Pat, Mike, you've missed these. You need to think about them. I think they're major. Drop us a line. We want to hear about it. Again, I cannot reiterate enough. Looking at these lists, looking at the fact that we've done 250 albums from this decade, and yet I feel like it's not a drop in the bucket. It's just overwhelming.
Right.
I mean, the amount of good and often great music out there, it is a flood. I mean, the gatekeepers are kind of gone. And if you're old school like Jazz Times, you can kind of still rely on them. And I'm not trying to be super critical of that. I mean, it makes sense that it'd be okay for a lot of people who like jazz to want to stay in that world because it's not quite so overwhelming. Everybody's only got so many hours in the day, And I think you're rarely going to get, like I said, I just recently heard a review album that should not have been released. That's rarely going to happen on a Blue Note or an ECM. There's going to be a level of professionalism there, if nothing else. I'm not sure all the most exciting stuff is there, but for sure, there's good stuff. So it's just, there's no way. And I don't think we've ever been able to, I've certainly never tried to pretend that I know all about what's going on in this field in any given week. There's just, you can't. It's more, you're just kind of taking soundings and seeing what you think about them. And of course, we don't want to spend all our time now. I mean, jazz has got a great rich history. And just to be honest, I spend a lot of my time listening to music that is older. It's not all my time, but a fair amount. And it's worth talking about artists who've been forgotten or you're worth returning to. Well, if we're ready for next week, do you have any pop matters on your mind? And I set you free, what you wanna be. Show me the way, and I'll let you see what you do to me. Well, it's not enough to live.
If you're gonna take, then you have to give. Before the dark, baby, you and I.
Yeah, two things recently went back into the rotation. One kind of deliberately, and then one randomly. The random thing was that went into the rotation. God Help Me More, Beach Boys, Fuck Me Sideways. And then Badfinger's BBC in Concert. My only reflections on this live Badfinger, it's concerts that they did over a couple of years, is, my God, when you hear them live, they sound even more like the Beatles than they do on their studio albums, which is quite an achievement since, you know, McCartney apparently was producing one or two of the studio albums at the beginning. Live, they sound even more like late era Beatles. It's really, if you want to hear, you know, they make those lists nowadays. If you like this, you might like that. If you like late era Beatles, you'll love that.
I've always felt sorry for them because, you know, to me, there's definitely resemblance. I think there's a resemblance in the accents. I think the difference is that they aren't quite the craftsmen that the Beatles are, but at the same time, the main songwriter, the greatest one, the Pete Ham, he just, the depth of feeling and melancholy there is just different in kind than the Beatles. I mean, he's kind of incoherent at times or just odd. And it's not like they're bad songwriters. I mean, they're fine, but they're just a little less polished. The lyrics are a little bit stranger, but there is this weird streak of melancholy through some of their stuff that, you know, does things that the Beatles don't do, because I think the Beatles ultimately were the world's greatest craftspeople and were great at playing roles. But, you know, there's certainly moments where they feel intimate, but an awful lot of it was just, you know, brilliance rather than, you know, the kind of not quite so brilliant, but maybe a little bit more heartfelt, a little bit strange, or a little bit more tangled up. Anyway, I like Badfinger. I really do. And they suffered in their time for their closeness to blues.
And I slapped into the rotation by choice. Sly and the Family Stones, now recognized as a classic.
A real uplifter, yeah.
What a fucking great album that is. For the kids who don't know, it came out in 71, and it's this tough funk, psychedelic funk album about dying as a junkie, among other things.
It fits in this year in a way that, it's just an incredibly depressing way. It's kind of the 60s dream being, because, you know, Sly's band was integrated from the very beginning. Men, women, black, whites, you know, very positive and uplift focused at the beginning. And then, and it partially due to his own kind of mental and chemically induced breakdowns, very different. But some of that was also just looking around and seeing that this goal wasn't being achieved. And of course, you could also do that this year. So.
Yeah, no. And it's, you know, it's got so many important figures on it as well. Like, it wasn't just, yeah, so he brought in Billy Preston and Ike Turner. It's an impressive piece of work. It's an important album. And yeah, it feels like the appropriate soundtrack to late summer, early fall election time. I don't know. It's working for me right now. I'm digging it. How about you?
I'm not there yet. I'm hoping to report in on, for some reason, I ran across an article praising Fleetwood Mac's Then Play On, like their third record back when they were sort of transitioning from being a blues outfit to something different. And some of the players were joining cults, and it was a really weird time for the group, which was constantly in transition for a while there. So I'm hoping to have some kind of coherent impression of that soon. The album I did get a chance to listen to a couple times, also an oldie, was Daryl Hall's Sacred Songs.
Which I have sung the praises of a zillion times.
Yeah, I know. And then eventually I broke down and finally got it. So there you go.
Thoughts? You like it, I hope.
I do. You know, Fripp is a producer, Robert Fripp, the guitar player, the mastermind of King Crimson. He was in a fallow period in the late 70s and kind of came back to music by producing these odd projects by the Roaches and Peter Gabriel and Paul, I think it's good. I think the Frippertronics aren't necessarily that well integrated with the music. I think some of the songs go on longer than they would have if a producer with a little stronger hand on the leash had been there. But at the same time, it's certainly raw, committed singing, sometimes a little too raw for my taste from Hall. I mean, he's got an amazing instrument, but he really pushes it. But there's an energy and directness to it. And it is just a little bit more ambitious than you might associate with Hall.
Well, you know, the story was Fripp desperately wanted Hall to be the lead singer for King Crimson and was willing to quit the band in order to make that happen. That's how strongly he felt about having Hall as the lead singer. And for a whole bunch of reasons, it just didn't work out. And this album, Sacred Songs, is like the album. It's like, this is what King Crimson might have sounded like in its mellower, more soulful moments. You know, I mean, because the one thing King Crimson never really had was a vocalist whose gifts quite matched the instrument, the towering instrumental talents of the band. You know, they had some good vocalists.
Well, Lake, yeah. I think Lake is probably their strongest, you know, on the original Court of the Crimson King. And Baloo was the one.
The weirdest.
He was weird, but he also brought some songwriting moxie and just frontman ability, because Fripp, if God knows, was never a frontman.
Right.
But yeah, they don't, most prog rock bands, by their very nature, don't tend to have good vocalists. A great exception, of course, being Radiohead. The only prog rock band ever led by a great vocalist, right?
What do you mean? Yes? What's wrong with Yes? Genesis?
Oh, God. You are a sick, sick man. Very sick. Yeah. I mean, sorry. Gabriel turned into a pretty good... But yes, it's just not a genre that attracts necessarily great singers. So, and I recorded Trot Mask Replica. I don't know when I'll listen to it again next. The Captain Beefheart opus.
Yeah. I had a Captain Beefheart phase a few years ago where I got everything I could get my hands on, which isn't much.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to do Lick My Decals Off, Baby. I've had that one ready to dub for a while. Yeah, it is not, one, some of it does sound a bit like free jazz.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm used to that genre at this point, certainly.
Zappa got his start there. A lot of the Mothers of Invention are Beefheart refugees.
And it's a weird record. I don't know ultimately where it stands on my scale of value. I know that as a listening experience, don't do it that often, not because it's so crazily abrasive, but just, you know, it's just poetry reading. There's some more overt humor. There's a lot of times they mention the phrase fast and bulbous. So it's like these weird in-jokes that you don't quite know what they're about, but there they are on the record. And it's the most Beefheart of all Beefheart recordings, so it tends to be the one that is fetishized the most. But, you know, I've got it now if I ever want to listen to it again. And that's pretty much what I've been doing recently in the pop realm.
Cool.
And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 200. If you've been with us since the very beginning, thanks for staying tuned in, and get psychiatric help as soon as you can. As always, you can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, and you can stream the podcast at All About Jazz. You can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com, theoretically mike@jazzbastard.com. Drop us a line on Facebook, and Facebook has not been forwarding the messages to me the way it used to. I'm going to go back to checking the page. I apologize for being out of tune there for a while. Or you can look me up at All About Jazz. Tune in next time when, if you've been listening closely, you already know that we're going to talk about work by Dave Holland and Chris Potter, Heath Jarrett and Charlie Hayden, Jack DeJohnette and friends, and Joe Lovano. Till next time, take care.